At this point, he compares the gifts, downplaying that of the tongues, indicating that it is neither completely useless nor extraordinarily useful by itself. In fact, they were extremely proud of this, as this gift was considered a significant one. It was deemed significant because the apostles received it first, and with such grandeur. However, it was not to be valued above all the others. Why did the apostles receive it before the rest? Because they were to spread the word everywhere. And as when the tower was being built, the one language was divided into many, then many languages often converged in one person, and this individual would converse in both Persian, Roman, Indian, and many other languages, the Spirit echoing within him. And this was termed as the gift of tongues, because he could speak various languages all at once. Notice how he both downplays and elevates it, by saying, "The one who speaks in tongues does not speak to people but to God, for no one understands." He downplays it, suggesting that its benefit is not significant, but by adding, "But in the Spirit he speaks mysteries," he elevates it again, so that it doesn't appear superfluous and useless and given in vain. "Pursue love and earnestly desire spiritual gifts, but more so that you may prophesy." So as he had accurately described to them all the greatness of love, he encourages them in what follows to quickly grab hold of it. That's why he said, "Pursue it," because someone who is in pursuit only sees what they are chasing, and toward that they exert themselves, and do not stop until they have caught it. Someone in pursuit, when they cannot do so alone, outpaces the one they are chasing with the help of those in front of them, pleading with those nearby to capture and keep it captive for them until they can catch up. Let us do the same. When we cannot reach love on our own, let us ask those near love to hold on to it until we can catch up to it, and once we have caught it, never let it go again, so that it does not escape us once more. For love consistently eludes us because we do not appreciate it the way we should, but consider everything else above it. Therefore, we should make every effort to fully retain it. If we do this, we will not need to work hard anymore, in fact, barely at all, but rested, celebrating, we will advance on the narrow path of virtue. That's why he says, "Pursue it." But he who prophesies speaks to men for edification, encouragement, and comfort. Do you see what he implies with the unique nature of this gift, that is, in the general advantage? And how everywhere he assigns the greater honor to that which promotes the benefit of many? For don't the first ones also speak to men as well? Please tell me. But not as much edification and exhortation and comfort. So the empowerment by the Spirit is common to both, to him who prophesies as well as to him who speaks in tongues. But in this, the one has an advantage in that he is also beneficial to the listeners. For those who spoke in tongues were not understood by those who didn't have the gift. Then, so they might not assume that he introduced the discussion of love for no other purpose than to diminish the gifts, he continues as follows, verse 1. "Still eagerly desire spiritual gifts, but more so that you may prophesy." So what? Did they not edify anyone? Yes, he says, but only themselves. Therefore, he also adds, verse 4, "The one who speaks in tongues edifies himself. For the person who speaks in a tongue does not speak to humans, but to God, because nobody understands, but through the Spirit they are speaking mysteries." And how, if he doesn't know what he's saying? Well, for now, he is talking about those who understand what they say, understand it themselves, but don't know how to explain it to others. But he who prophesies speaks to men for their edification, encouragement, and comfort. But he who prophesies builds up the church. Now, the difference between an individual and the church is massive, just like the gap between these two. Do you see his wisdom, how he doesn't reject the gift or devalues it, but implies it to have some benefit, small though it may be, and enough to satisfy only the possessor? Next, in case they might believe that he is devaluing the tongues out of envy towards them, he states to clear up their suspicion, verses 5. "I would like you all to speak in tongues, but I prefer that you should prophesy. Because the one who prophesies is greater than the one who speaks in tongues, unless he interprets, so that the church may receive edification. But rather and greater do not indicate opposition, but superiority." So from this, it's also clear that he is not belittling the gift, but guiding them towards higher things, revealing both his concern for their welfare and a mind free from any envy. For he didn't say, I wish that just two or three, but that you all spoke in tongues, and not just this, but also that you prophesied. And this more so than that, for the one who prophesies is greater. Since he has established and validated it, he then goes on to declare it, but not outright, rather with a condition. Therefore he adds, unless he interprets, as if he is capable of this, meaning interpreting, he has become equivalent to the prophet, he proclaims, because then there are many who can benefit from it. An essential point to consider that this, above all, is his goal. But now, brothers, if I come to you speaking in tongues, how will I benefit you unless I speak to you either in the form of revelation or of knowledge, or of prophesying or of teaching? And why do I mention the rest? He asks. Even if the person speaking in tongues were Paul, it wouldn't bring any benefit to those listening. He says these things to indicate that he's seeking their benefit, not holding any grudge against those who have this gift. Even when it concerns himself, he's not shy in pointing out its lack of usefulness. Indeed, his regular approach is to address the unpleasant topics in his own context. For instance, at the beginning of the epistle he asked, "Who is Paul? Who is Apollos? Who is Cephas?" He does the same here, saying, "Even I won't be of any use to you unless I speak to you through revelation or prophecy or knowledge or teaching." What he's trying to say is, if I don't express something that can be understood by you and made clear, if I merely show off my ability to speak in tongues, tongues you don't comprehend, you'll walk away without gaining anything. How could you benefit from a voice you don't understand? But if it's unprofitable, why was it given? Someone might ask. Well, it's to be useful to the person who received it, but if it's also to be useful to others, interpretation needs to be added. Now, this is said to bring them closer to one another. In case a person doesn't have the gift of interpretation, they can connect with someone who has it and make their own gift useful through them. Therefore, he constantly points out its relative lack of completeness with the aim to unite them. Anyway, the one who considers it to be sufficient on its own doesn't so much praise it as depreciate it, not allowing it to shine brightly through interpretation. The gift is indeed wonderful and necessary, but it is so when there is someone to explain what is spoken. As with the finger, it is a necessary thing. But when you separate it from the other members, its utility diminishes. Likewise, a trumpet is necessary, but when it's blown without reason, it becomes a nuisance. No art can show up without a subject to work with, just as a subject cannot be transformed without a guide or a form. Consider the voice to be the subject, but the clarity as the form that provides the voice with its purpose, without which the voice holds no significance. Verse 7. Even lifeless things that make sounds, whether a flute or a harp, if they don't produce distinguishable notes, how can we understand what is being played? Verse 10. There may be so many types of voices in the world, and no type is without meaning. That is, so many languages, so many voices of Scythians, Thracians, Romans, Persians, Moors, Indians, Egyptians, countless other nations. And why do I suggest, he says, that in our case this is unhelpful, and only that which is clear and easily understood by the listeners is beneficial? This can even be seen in lifeless musical instruments, be it a flute or a harp. If they're played clumsily or unskillfully, without proper rhythm or melody, it will not captivate any of the audience. Even in these non-speech sounds, there's a need for clarity. If you don't play or blow into the flute properly, you've achieved nothing. Now, if we require such clarity, harmoniousness, and appropriateness from lifeless things, and strive and compete to instill so much meaning into these non-speech sounds, then even more so in people gifted with life and reason and in spiritual gifts, one should aim for meaningfulness. Verse 11, if I don't understand the meaning of the voice, I will be a foreigner to the person who is speaking. Don't assume, he says, that this only occurs in our situation. You can see this happening everywhere. So I'm not trying to belittle the voice, but to show that it's useless to me if it's not understandable. Then, to make sure his criticism isn't too harsh, he balances blame between the two. He will be a foreigner to me, and I to him. Not because of the nature of the voice, but due to our lack of understanding. Do you see how he gradually guides people towards the core topic? This is typical for him. He uses examples from far and wide, and finishes with what most closely relates to the matter at hand. After discussing a pipe and a harp, which have many shortcomings, he shifts to the trumpet, which is more useful. From there, he moves to the voice itself. Similarly, when he was discussing that it was not forbidden for the apostles to receive, starting with farmers, shepherds, and soldiers, he eventually brought the discussion to the priests in the Old Covenant, which is more directly related to the topic. For if the trumpet makes an uncertain sound, who will prepare himself for war? But I ask you, please, to consider how everywhere he has made efforts to protect the gift from criticism and to redirect the blame to the recipients of it. For he didn't say, "I will be a barbarian," but "to the one who speaks, a barbarian." And again, he didn't say, "the one who speaks will be a barbarian," but "the one who speaks will be a barbarian to me." Thus, from purely decorative items, he extends his argument to those that are more necessary and useful, and says that not only in the harp, but also in the trumpet, one may witness this effect. For even in the trumpet, there are certain pitches, sometimes emitting a warlike tone, and at other times not so, leading troops into battle at times, and at other times drawing them back. And if one does not understand this, there's considerable risk. This is exactly his point, and the potential harm is what he's highlighting when he says, "Who shall prepare himself for war?" So then, if it doesn't have this quality, it leads to the downfall of all. "And what does this have to do with us?" someone asks. "Indeed, it directly concerns you," which is why he also adds, "What then must be done?" he asks. "Far from belittling it, one should promote and teach it as he himself does." After he had accused and criticized it and shown its uselessness, he goes on to advise them, saying, verse 9, "So also you, unless you express with the tongue speech that is easy to be understood, you will be speaking into the air," meaning calling to nobody, speaking to no one. In this way, he continually demonstrates its unprofitability. "So also, since you are eager for spiritual gifts, strive to excel in building up the church." Do you see his aim everywhere? How he constantly focuses on one thing in all situations, the general benefit, the profiting of the church, setting this as a kind of rule. And he didn't say, "so that you may get the gifts," but "so that you may abound," meaning that you may even possess them in great abundance. "Thus, I am far from not wanting you to have them, but I actually want you to have plenty of them, as long as you use them for the common good." And how is this to be done? He adds this, saying, "Therefore, the one who speaks in a tongue should pray to be able to interpret. For if I pray in a different language, my spirit is praying, but my understanding is unproductive." Verse 15. So what does it mean? "I will pray spiritually, but I will also pray with understanding. I will sing spiritually, and I will sing with understanding as well." Here he demonstrates that they have the ability to receive the gift. He insists, "Let him pray," meaning let him do his part, since if you ask earnestly, you will certainly receive. Accordingly, ask not only for the ability to speak in tongues, but also for interpretation, so you can be helpful to everyone and not keep your gift to yourself. "For if I pray in a tongue," he says, "my spirit prays, but my understanding gains nothing." Can you see how he gradually refines his argument to suggest that such a person is not only useless to others, but also to themselves, especially if their understanding is unfruitful? For if someone only speaks in Persian or any other foreign language and doesn't understand what they are saying, they will, of course, also be a barbarian to themselves, not just to others, because they don't understand the meaning of the words. For anciently, many had the gift of prayer along with speaking in tongues. They prayed, their tongue spoke, praying either in Persian or Latin, but their understanding didn't know what was being said. That's why he said, "If I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays." In other words, the gift given to me that moves my tongue, but my understanding gains nothing. And he does this in another place with a specific intent, particularly to remove the benefits of Judaism and to indicate that they henceforth amount to nothing, beginning by stating he himself had received these benefits, yes, even in great excess. Then he refers to them as loss, in saying, "If any man thinks he can rely on the flesh, I do so even more. I was circumcised on the eighth day, from the line of Israel, from the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew among Hebrews. According to the law, I was a Pharisee. In terms of zeal, I persecuted the church. In terms of the righteousness demanded by the law, I was found blameless. Then, having indicated that he had more significant advantages overall, he says, "However, the things that were profitable to me, I considered them a loss for Christ's sake." In the same way he does here, stating, "I speak in languages more than all of you. Do not boast as if you alone possess this gift, because I also have it indeed more than you do. However, in the church I would rather speak 5 words with my understanding, so that I might also instruct others." What does it mean, "speak with my understanding, so that I might teach others as well"? It means understanding what I say, and using words that I can both explain to others and speak intelligently, so I can educate those who listen. More beneficial than speaking 10,000 words in a foreign language. Why? "So that I may teach others," he says. "Because the one only serves to show off, while the other is of great usefulness. This is what he consistently seeks, referring to the common good. However, the gift of tongues was unusual, while that of prophecy was familiar, ancient, and previously given to many. On the other hand, the gift of tongues was something new at that time. But he didn't care much for it. That's why he didn't use it. Not because he didn't possess it, but because he always sought what was most beneficial. Being as he was, devoid of all vanity, his sole concern was how he could better the listeners. And here is the reason for his ability to consider what is beneficial for both himself and others, viz. Because he was free from vanity. Since the individual who is enslaved by vanity, rather than understanding what is right for others, will not even recognize their own good. Such was the case with Simon, who was so focused on vanity and glory that he failed to recognize his own benefit. Similarly, the Jews sacrificed their salvation to the devil due to their vanity. This is the root of idol worship, which roused up the pagan philosophers and led them to disaster in their erroneous doctrines. Notice the absurdity of this obsession. Because of it, some deliberately impoverished themselves, while others eagerly sought wealth. The force of vanity is so strong that it controls the most opposite behaviors. Hence, one person may feel vain about purity, whereas another feels the same about indulging in immorality. One takes pride in justice, another in injustice. It drives some to luxury and others to fasting, some towards modesty and others towards recklessness, some to riches and others to poverty. I mention poverty since some, when they had the capacity to acquire wealth for the sake of admiration, chose not to. But the apostles were different. They proved their freedom from vanity through their actions. When some hailed them as gods and were ready to offer them lavish sacrifices, they not only stopped this action but even tear their clothes in disapproval. And when they made the lame man walk, and everyone gaped in awe, they said, "Why are you looking at us as if we made this man walk through our own power?" Of those who admired poverty, they chose it for themselves while living among those who scoffed at poverty and extolled wealth. If they received anything, they shared it with the needy. Thus, charity, not vanity, was their motivation. But the vain love-glory above love of mankind, they squandered their goods on foolish, selfish pursuits. Unlike the apostles, who received and graciously offered up necessities, sharing with those in need so generously that they frequently suffered hunger themselves. Had they coveted glory, they wouldn't have practiced this giving and receiving for fear of suspicion. For someone who discards their own possessions for vanity's sake would certainly reject the gifts of others, not wishing to appear needy or arouse doubt. Yet the apostles we observe not only caring for the poor, but even begging on their behalf, showing their deep capacity for love. And also observe their laws, how reasonable and devoid of all vanity. As it says, "Having food and covering, let us be content." Unlike the man from Sinope, who dressed in rags and lived in a barrel to no good purpose, he astonished many but helped no one. While Paul did none of these things, he was dressed in regular clothes with complete decency and lived in a house on a regular basis, demonstrating careful adherence to all other virtues, virtues that the cynic disregarded, living obscenely and openly humiliating himself and being led astray by his insane longing for fame. Indeed, if anyone were to ask why he lived in a barrel, they would find no other reason except vanity. But Paul also paid rent for the house he lived in Rome, even though he who could perform even stricter tasks could undoubtedly have had the strength for this. But he had no regard for glory, that fierce beast, that terrifying demon, that scourge of the world, that venomous snake. For like the snake that bites its way through the womb of its own mother, this passion rips apart whoever gives it birth. So, how can someone find a remedy for this pervasive malaise? By taking inspiration from those who have successfully overcome it, modeling our own behavior after theirs. Let's look at the patriarch Abraham as an example. Don't accuse me of repetition if I often refer to him. It's precisely his exceptional qualities and the fact that he serves as the ultimate example which make it inexcusable for anyone not to imitate him. Indeed, if we presented different people embodying different virtues, one might argue that attaining true virtue is nearly impossible, since it would be hard to excel in all those areas simultaneously, areas in which each saint has only partially excelled. But when one person, like Abraham, embodies all virtues, what excuse can those who, despite the law and grace, fail to achieve the same level of virtuousness as those who lived before the law and grace? So how did Abraham conquer this beast of pride during his disagreement with his nephew? In the distribution of lands, Abraham didn't gain the most advantageous part, yet he wasn't upset. It's important to realize that in public opinion, the humiliation from such an event is worse than the material loss, especially in a situation where Abraham could have easily exerted his power and demanded first choice due to his seniority. But even after being slighted by his nephew, a younger man, Abraham wasn't angry or resentful. Instead, he kept on loving him and supporting him. Also, after his victorious combat against the barbarians, he didn't showcase his win or erect a trophy. His goal was to achieve peace, not to boast about his victory. Moreover, he showed modesty when he hosted strangers. He didn't seek praise for his hospitality, but instead, he displayed humility. He went out to greet them and bowed down to them, treating them as if he was the one benefiting from their visit. Although he had earned a title of honor from the Egyptians and had his wife returned to him, he didn't announce this to everyone. Even when the locals referred to him as a prince, he insisted on paying for his own burial spot. When he sent to arrange a marriage for his son, he didn't ask for his family to be spoken of in grandiose terms, but only that a bride would be brought. To conclude, the goal is not to attain superficial success or fame, but to practice humility and love in our daily lives, to be selfless, peaceful, and compassionate like Abraham. Will you also scrutinize the behavior of those who are under grace when a great glory of teaching surrounded them, and witness then this passion being eliminated? Look at this same apostle who voices these things, always ascribing the entirety to God, continually mentioning his sins yet, never his good deeds, unless it might be necessary to correct the disciples. And even if he is forced to do this, he refers to it as foolishness, gives priority to Peter, and is not embarrassed to work with Priscilla and Aquila. He is always striving to portray himself as humble, not strutting about in the marketplace or gathering crowds, but positioning himself amongst the ordinary. Due to this, he remarked, "But his bodily presence is weak, that is, easy to scorn, and not associated with any ostentation." Again, he said, "I pray that you do no evil, not that we may appear approved." Is it undeniable that he disregards this glory? After all, he thinks little of the splendor of heaven, the kingdom, and hell for what pleases Christ, as he wishes to be condemned from Christ for Christ's glory. For if he declares his readiness to endure this for the Jews' sake, he does so in order that none of those lacking understanding might presume to claim the promises made to them. Therefore, if he is prepared to overlook those things, it is not surprising that he dismisses human things. But the people of our era are burdened by everything, not just by the lust for fame, but also, on the other hand, by insult and fear of disgrace. Thus, if someone praises you, it would inflate your ego, and if they criticize you, it would bring you down. And just as frail bodies are harmed by everyday mishaps, so are the souls that are stuck in worldly matters. For such individuals, not only poverty but even wealth can be destructive, not just sorrow but also joy, and prosperity more than hardship. For poverty forces you to be wise, but wealth often leads to some significant catastrophe. And just like people with fever are difficult to satisfy in any aspect, so are those that have a corrupt mind are prone to harm from all directions. Therefore, knowing these things, let's not avoid poverty. Let's not idolize riches, but ready our soul to be equipped for all situations. For just as anyone building a house doesn't worry about whether rain might fall or sunlight might shine upon it, but rather ensures that the house can withstand all conditions. And similarly, the one who builds a ship doesn't design anything to prevent the waves from crashing against it or any storm from brewing in the sea, but that the ship's structure may be ready to face all. And also, he who cares for the body doesn't strive for there to be no fluctuations in body temperature, but that the body can easily endure all these changes. So we should behave regarding the soul, and neither be eager to escape poverty nor to accumulate wealth, but to manage either of them for our own safety. Therefore, setting aside these matters, let's prepare our soul to handle both wealth and poverty. For even if we aren't subject to the common hardships mankind faces, which is largely improbable, it is still better to not seek wealth, but rather know how to handle all situations with ease than to always be rich. Why? Firstly, the strong person finds security from within, while the other seeks it externally. Just like a better soldier is one who relies on their physical abilities and combat skills rather than just their armor, the person who depends on their wealth is inferior to the one protected by their virtue. Secondly, it's impossible for a wealthy person to live without troubles. Wealth carries many storms and worries, unlike virtue, which only offers pleasure and safety. Moreover, virtue keeps a person safe from those who set traps for them, while wealth makes a person more vulnerable to attacks. Just as in the animal kingdom, stags and hares are easily captured due to their natural fearfulness, while the wild boar, bull, and lion are less likely to fall into traps. The same can be observed in the case of the rich and those living in voluntary poverty. The latter are akin to the lion and the bull, and the former to the stag and hare. For who doesn't the rich person fear? Aren't there thieves, rulers, jealous people, informants? And it's not just thieves and informants they worry about. Even their own household can't be trusted. And why do I say, while he is alive? He's not even freed from the malevolence of the robbers when he's dead. Nor does death have the power to protect him. But the wrongdoers rob him even in death. So perilous is wealth. For they not only break into houses, but they also break open graves and coffins. What then could be more pitiful than this man, since not even death can guarantee him this safety? But that miserable body, even when lifeless, is not freed from life's adversities. Those who commit such wickedness are quick to wage war even with dust and ashes, and much more severely than when he was alive. For then, perhaps by penetrating his storehouse, they might steal his chests, but refrain from his physical body, and wouldn't go so far as stripping the body itself. But now, the cursed hands of the grave robbers do not even refrain from these, but move and disturb it, and with much cruelty disrespect it. For after it has been interred, having stripped it both of its layer of earth and what its grave clothes provide, they leave it discarded. So what might be the best in itself and does good? And how should one behave, or what should one ask of God? To pray both with the spirit, meaning the gift, and with the understanding. This is why it was said, I will pray with the spirit, and I will pray with the understanding also. I will sing with the spirit, and I will sing with the understanding also. He signifies the same thing here as well, that both the tongue may speak, and the understanding may not be ignorant of the things spoken. For unless this is the case, there will also be another confusion. Verse 16. Otherwise, he says, if you bless with the spirit, how can the person who occupies the position of the unlearned say Amen to your expression of thanks, given that he does not understand what you are saying? Verse 17. Indeed, you give thanks well, but the other is not built up. Notice how once again he aligns his stance with the cornerstone, always focused on the growth of the church. Now, by uneducated, he's referring to laymen, indicating that he too suffers a considerable loss when he is unable to say the Amen. And his argument is as follows. If you pray in a foreign language, not understanding what you're saying or unable to interpret it, the layman cannot say the Amen. For if he doesn't hear the words, forever and ever, which are at the end, he won't say the Amen. Then again, providing consolation in relation to this, so that he wouldn't undervalue the gift too much. This parallels his earlier remarks that he speaks mysteries and speaks to God, and builds himself up and prays with the Spirit, extracting substantial comfort from these things, he makes the same point here, implying, "For you do give thanks well, since you pray being led by the Spirit." But the other, hearing nothing and not understanding what is said, is left standing there, gaining little benefit from it. Furthermore, because he had criticized the possessors of this gift as if they didn't have anything significant, to ensure that he didn't appear to devalue them, given that he lacked it himself, pay attention to what he says. "I thank God, for I speak in tongues more than all of you.